It's not hard to draw a parallel between Marshall McLuhan and author Douglas Copeland. Like McLuhan, Copeland is Canadian, and while McLuhan coined such memorable maxims as the medium is the message, Copeland came up with the term Generation X in his 1991 best-selling novel of the same name. And both men are known for their sharp culture-watching skills and prescience about society in the future. Copeland has a new book out. It's called Marshall McLuhan, You Know Nothing of My Work. Copeland's biography isn't your traditional McLuhan biography. It features MapQuest directions and McLuhan's pirate and Mexican wrestler names, courtesy of online name generators. Copeland told Steve Paulson why he wanted to take such an unconventional approach.
I just thought it was interesting to show the manifestation of his ideas, as well as the ideas themselves and how he came about them. By the way, his drag queen name is Vanilla Thunderstorm. So that's where that's coming from. In terms of using MapQuest, when he went moving on up from one house to the house on the hill, why not include directions on how he got there? You know, turn left on Yonge Street, go forward three blocks, that kind of thing. It just seems like, A, it does turn out he was right, but B, I think the larger thing is, okay, then if he's right about this and he started 2,000 years ago, worked up to the present, and then slightly into the future, he died in 1980, well, he's probably further right. It doesn't end at 2011. It probably goes a lot further ahead. Look at all these new technologies. McLuhan was always saying that they would reinforce tribalism or they would reinforce community. For everything from people with cystic fibrosis, people with gambling addictions, you name it, there's an online community. But even more largely, you know, does it support secularism or does it support a theocratic state? And we haven't quite figured that out there. I think we thought it was a theocratic state for a while, but then there was the Arab Spring. And so a lot of this stuff's still playing out.
Right. You write about a condition which you call time sickness. Can you explain what this is, time sickness?
There's that old cliche of his, the medium is the message, which Marshall invented or came up with or whatever in the late 50s, early 60s, back when television was new and exciting and people were sort of paranoid about it. They thought that, you know, because it's electronic, that it crosses the free will membrane that books don't, and that if you saw communism on TV, then you would become communist. And then what he was saying in a broader sense is that what matters isn't what you're watching on TV. What matters is that you're watching TV itself. And I think if you look into the present, forget TV, we've had to absorb about 15 new technologies in about a decade, and they keep coming at us, boom, boom, boom. And what's happening as a result of this is that we know that 99% of what we say in texts and phone messages and emails and everything else is just crap. But the message is that we're doing all this, and it is warping our sense of time, our perception of time.
Is that to say that it's speeding up time, or are you talking about something else?
It's the perception of time. I mean, it's July as we tape this interview right now. Good God, what happened in the first 6 months of the year? I barely remember them happening. And it's not a function of me just being older and 1 year is less, a smaller percentage of your life. We all kind of know it in our heart that we've done something to our perception of time. It's just gone all crazy. And that is the message of all this media we're using. It's just like, wow, we're all these media. Like, hi, I'm your cell phone. And I'm messing with your sense of time, basically.
Do you think that alarmed McLuhan? I mean, that in a sense we were stepping out of, I guess, what you might call organic or biological time and creating a new kind of time?
I would actually argue that in a weird way all this technology is far more organic because it allows people to manifest their humanity more quickly. I mean, whenever the plane lands at the airport, the first thing every single person in the plane does is, you know, grabs their BlackBerry or their iPhone or what have you. And you have to remember, he was this crusty fuddy-duddy guy in Toronto in the 50s, and he not just didn't like, he hated the 20th century. He hated technology. He thought it was inhumane. He wanted to live like centuries around the time of the Gutenberg press.
How could he hate technology? He was the great prophet of the coming age of technology.
There's your irony for you. Oh no, he was a devout Catholic. For him, all that mattered was the afterlife, and you know, existence on this plane was sort of a trial or something you had to go through. I mean, in his early life, he came from sort of a very prairie, well, a Canadian prairie, Protestant background. sort of like my own, which gave me a little bit of a plus in understanding him. So he was quite at home with endgame theology or the end of days, that kind of thing. So for the world to end or for the world to be a disaster was like, okay, well, that's just, you know, I heard about that when I was young. I'm okay with that. And it's kind of depressing, actually. And you thought that the only thing that was actually going to save human or mankind was natural law.
Was there some connection then between his belief as in the afterlife as a good Catholic and this new technological future he was imagining?
When he was giving his lectures at sort of his peak, it wasn't just students in his own class who would show up. I mean, hundreds of people would show up, celebrities or his people had heard, like, you got to hear this guy talk. And when he spoke in front of a crowd, he would just go off on a tangent almost immediately. And he was his own radio station, and he didn't really take Q&A from the audience or anything like that. And half the people in his class were probably tripping on acid when they were watching him. And he looked at all these kids with their long, greasy hair and their outfits, and he was just disgusted by them. But he never actually said that out loud. He said it elsewhere. No, he just, I don't know what to say here. He didn't like the modern condition, and he saw no hope in it. So what would he think of the internet is my question. He'd probably think it's very, very interesting, but he's probably quite happy to be in heaven right now.
Well, this is so fascinating because you're really describing a man who was, he probably would have rather have not even have lived in the 20th century, let alone the 21st century. I don't know. He probably would have liked to have lived in, I don't know, the 16th century or something like that.
And oh, well, actually, that's pretty bang on. And in a strange way, he got what he wished for. And you have to remember with Marshall, he had an extraordinary brain. He had a number of conditions that we might call mild Asperger's. He was an extraordinary mimic. He had an amazing memory. He had this vein that went from the base of his neck into the left lobe of his brain, which in mammals is a form of blood circulation found only in cats. So he really did have a freakish brain. He had a massive brain tumor removed. I think it was 67.
Wait, so you're saying he had an extra artery going into his brain, like one more than everyone else?
Yes, indeed, into the left lobe of his brain. He's medically extraordinary. And so he had all of these conditions going. And then he had a number of little baby strokes throughout 60s and 70s. Sometimes like he'd be speaking in front of a class and he'd just stop, like freeze for about 60 seconds and then suddenly thaw and go back to where he was. And in the last year of his life, he had a catastrophic stroke. What the stroke did was it removed his ability to formulate words or to read words. And so that if he was sitting in your living room, he would look around him and he would know what everything was, but he couldn't make the name for it in his head, or he couldn't even have an internal dialogue with himself. But if you walked in and said, like, hi, I'm sitting in the chair right now, and like, oh, look at that robin outside in the yard, and he'd know exactly what you were saying. A very, very specific and strange kind of stroke. And it which did return him to a pre-literary era, for better or for worse. And, well, he died in 1980. So, yeah, and be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's also fascinating because he was a literary man. I mean, to his toes. He had gone off in the mid-1930s to the University of Cambridge to study with some of the great literary scholars of the day, and he encountered what became known as the New Criticism, the literary movement that emphasized the close reading of literary works. Do you think that kind of literary training helped to shape his later thinking about technology?
You actually might even go a little bit earlier than that. His mother, Elsie, was an elocutionist in the Canadian prairies back in the teens and the 20s. She had this gift, which Marshall received from her genetically, where she could look at something once, memorize it forever, and then do astonishing accents. Marshall, he was apparently a terrible student in school until his mother turned him on to elocution, which is good for her because now she had an elocution buddy in the house and they could talk shop together. And so when he went to Cambridge, everyone thought, oh, here's this yokel from the colonies. And suddenly, like, boom, he's just like, you know, reading the great works of history back with the proper accent or brogue or what have you. And he got a lot of, you know, street cred at Cambridge for that. I think what happened was he saw literature maybe ending with Finnegan's Wake. I think that was sort of the end of literature in a lot of ways, where
James Joyce's great book that no one understands, that this was his favorite book.
Well, yeah. And I mean, it sort of represented the point in history where words stop being words, they just become sound effects, and where sort of language collapses on itself. And he found that fascinating. And I don't think he ever really cared for anything written after that. Again, he was not a 20th century man.
And yet he was, in some ways, the prophet of the late 20th century in terms of the technology that he created.
Yeah, no, it is an irony.
Yeah. Well, you say that he was a master of pattern recognition, and that's to some degree what he looked for when he was reading James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake or going back to the 16th century Reformation pamphleteers. He was looking for the way this stuff fit together.
Well, yeah. He saw the modern world as a maelstrom, and which was trying to pull you and everyone else down into the void. And his thinking was that the only way that you can remain cohesive as an individual or to keep your sense of self intact was to attempt pattern recognition, was to try and find patterns wherever you could. And you might not find them, but the act of searching for patterns will in some way keep you afloat. And it's actually pretty good advice and pretty germane at the moment, I might add.
Douglas Copeland is a writer and artist. He's the author of Marshall McLuhan, You Know Nothing of My Work. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
Instead of going out and buying a packaged book, of which there have been 5,000 copies printed, you will go to the telephone, describe your interests, your needs, your problems, and they at once Xerox, with the help of computers from the libraries of the world, all the latest material just for you personally, not as something to be put out on the bookshelf. They send you the package as a direct personal service. This is where we're heading under electronic information conditions.